Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, October 27th, 2016. Voter fraud, oh my goodness. People are reporting as they go into vote, the voting machines, they make their selection, and then they go to select, and it pops up, and it changes their selection. They're changing Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton and others. There's a man that went in, and he was running himself for political office. He went in and voted for himself, and the voting machine changed his vote for the opposing candidate. This is insane. If you walk up to a vending machine at an airport or at a bus station or any place, you put in your 50 cents and you want a candy bar, and you go, you know, E3, and out drops your candy bar. You know, what would you say if you pushed E3 and the candy bar that you wanted, that's supposed to be E3, something worth a nickel came out? And then you're standing there, you have nobody to talk to about this. Insane that voting machines that should be, absolutely 100% correct. And then when the people go back to the people in charge, they go, oh, there's a calibration error on that machine. Calibration error? What do you mean calibration error? This is just graft, corruption, fraud at the highest levels. The people who own the voting machines are like George Soros. It's a company of George Soros. Anyway, I also want to talk about statistics of polling. Now, I taught statistics at the university level. It's something I happen to know a little bit about. There's a book that came out back in probably the 80s sometime. It was called Lying with Statistics, and it showed how companies would alter statistics and vary the way things were stated simply to try and make a point of regarding selling their products. Now, here's an example of how you would use polling, in a sense, to determine something statistically. And this all began in World War II when they were doing statistical samples of various things. But say you have a factory that's making bolts and nuts and bolts. And the machines, of course, are not perfect, so the nuts and bolts come out a little bit different. A little bit longer, a little bit shorter, whatever. And you want to know the number that are within variance on this machine. So say you're making 1 million bolts. Well, you don't have to measure every bolt. You don't have to take every bolt and measure it. You can take a statistical sampling, because chances are everything that's being made by that machine will fall into the statistical range. And then you'll have a sampling of the accuracy of the machine and the million bolts and nuts in this production lot as a whole. So anyway, if you have 1 million items, it's probably safe to say that you could use not 5%, not 3%, but possibly 1% of the bolts to take your measurements. And so you measure meticulously the length and all the properties of the bolts and nuts that, but 1%. 1% of 1 million is 10,000. So you would measure 10,000 bolts. So this is on a statistical number, a statistical sampling of 1 million. But these are hardware. These are things that you can measure and put on a table with a measuring device and measure. Statistical sampling of people becomes very different. For example, let us imagine we're taking a statistical sampling of eye color. Okay, so you go down into New Orleans, down into the 7th Ward, and you do a statistical sampling of eye color, and it turns out that literally 100% of the people there have brown eyes. Would you say that that's a representative sampling of all the people that live in the United States? Well, no, it's skewed because where you're taking the sample. If you took an eye sample of all of the people that lived in Minnesota, you would probably not find statistically the same sampling of brown eyes. So there you would have a sampling more of blue eyes, hazel eyes, green eyes, and a much smaller percentage of brown eyes. But would you use that statistical sampling of representative of the United States? No, that would not be representative either. Would you take a statistical sampling of all the major cities of a certain part of an income group, high income group or low income group in all the cities, and take 100 people out of every city and say that that was representative of eye color in the country of the United States? No. Okay, now let's talk about something much more esoteric, voting. Would you go, how would you do a statistical sampling? And what they do is they take certain percentage of Democrats, certain percentage of Republicans, and then they take a so-called independent group and they call them up, and it might be a sampling of as few as 100 people. This is not a statistical sampling that would be valid in anybody's statistic book. When you start dealing with characteristics of humans, eye color is something that's fixed. Tomorrow, your eye color is going to be the same as it was yesterday, and in a week, and in a month, into the future, and into the past. Voting is different. It can change today, it can change tomorrow, it can be different than what it was yesterday or last week. So the sampling of and polling, I believe, should simply be made illegal. How the news media has come up with this, and also then you have news media that is controlled by certain candidates. So what they do is they do an oversampling of one statistical group, which favors their record keeping, and then publish these results. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. So anyway, when you hear about polls and things like that, it really doesn't make any sense. Now, there's all kinds of other sampling qualifications that would have to be made, but literally in the statistical sense, my point is polling does not make sense at all. There's no rationale of any kind for creating meaningful statistics by polling people, individuals, calling them up on the phone. Well, let's just imagine how many people are working when they're taking the poll. So people that are working are not going to be answering their phone. Only people that don't work would be answering during the times they're calling. Okay, anyway, I'm going to change gears just a little bit here. This past week, October 21st, there was a massive cyber attack on the United States, primarily the eastern part of the United States. And I don't know if this is a result of Biden making threats to Russia, but, when these things happen, let me explain something also about the claim that Russia is doing hacking in the United States with an effort to steer the election. It is the most ridiculous claim. It's very simply, this is the logic that you would have to use. If the Department of Homeland Security and 17 other federal agencies determined that it was Russia that did the hacking, why didn't they recognize it at the time and stop it? This is a failure. It's an incompetence in the federal government regarding cybersecurity. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. I worked in the telecommunications industry and for 10 years of my life built private networks. Literally, the company I worked for built private networks that were extremely secure, and it can be done. I don't know what's going on today, but there's total incompetence in the telecommunications industry that they cannot build systems that are secure. Much of this has to do with the NSA and its insistence on being able to get into all computing systems, whether they're for business, your personal phone or laptop, tablet, or whatever, your personal home equipment. That leads into business equipment, and the end result is that they insist on having a backdoor into everybody's computer. That is the same backdoor that hackers use, and it's absolutely child's play to get into any computing system, including the most secure computing systems in the government. So when these, the DDoS is what is called, it's denial of service attack, happened in the United States this past week. The denial of service, what they do is they simply flood the internet with requests. And so, say, for example, you have a web page or you have a server where your company website is stored or whatever. If you're set up for an average number of, say, you know, so many hits, so many entries per hour, per day, or whatever. If somebody comes along and fires thousands or hundreds of thousands of requests at you, at your server or your web page in a short amount of time, then that's a DDoS. That prevents anybody else from getting in. And then the objective is to break through the firewall. The firewall, while it's trying to manage one entry and block it, other ones are getting in. And it's really a failure of the design of secure computing equipment. When we built secure computing networks, there was never a break-in, ever. It can be done, as I said, it's just strictly incompetence in the cyber world today. And Trump should jump all over this. I mean, he should jump on the fact that your cybersecurity is not safe. Your home, your business, your county, your state government, your federal government, there's no cybersecurity anymore. It's just like taking candy from a baby. So my point is that there has to be cybersecurity, but since the government, in fact, is responsible for the fact that there is no cybersecurity, but remember that the security of the United States is not the issue when the levels of control that manage the United States are up above it. They don't care about the United States security or computer security at all. They don't care. It's not on their agenda. It's not important. So anyway, that's cybersecurity is a very important issue. I started at one point about maybe half a year ago. It was called Windroids 11 OS, and it was a replacement operating system for Windows 10 and Android. And so I put the terms together. It was called Windroids, and I used the number 11 because Windows 10 was the operating system of the day, and then OS represents operating system. And the idea was to build an operating system that was bug-free. Now, when you get a computer today, you are forced to buy Windows 10. Well, maybe that's good. That would be good in a normal world. But what happens is that the NSA hooks into spyware are already in the middle of that machine, in the operating system. So if you buy spyware to block any attempts at getting into your computer, the spyware is already at a layer below that where you put your spyware. So at any rate, it's impossible, literally, to block out the hooks that are in there for the NSA to get into your machine to see who all your contacts are, everything you do, who you email, where you are, whatever it is. And hackers use those same devices to get into your computer. I should mention that last week my show was on cybersecurity, and so I just wanted to brush on a couple of those points this week. This week's main science topic, I'll be talking about Planet X type topics. On my paid cast, I discussed one of the very first shows back in August, how to tell the difference between an internet announcement of Planet X or a YouTube announcement, how to tell the difference between a phony one and a real one. In fact, I got a call. What show was I on this past week? Tim Spencer's show. By the way, I was a guest with Tim Spencer. Now has a Saturday morning 10 a.m. Central Time radio show on RBN. And he called me up after that and he said, we set a record for listenership. So that was rather exciting that I was on the show that set a listenership record for RBM. That was last Saturday morning. So Tim's show is on 10 a.m. Saturday mornings. I suggested you give a listen. And yesterday, I'm always on John Moore's show at 8 o'clock Central Time, every Wednesday morning. And yesterday, well, there were some technical difficulties, and we did not have a show at all. It was just dead air. So we're living in a strange world. That's all I can tell you. But anyway, back to the topic of, first of all, I should talk about this, the European Space Union and the Russian Space Agency. Russian space agency is called Roscosmos, have a joint effort. And I mentioned this during my show last week, and I had not gotten the news yet, although I believe it happened before my show last week. I had not gotten the news that the Schiaparelli lander did not make it to the surface. Now, this is in a long string of foreign, in other words, non-U.S., attempts to visit the planet Mars. We've had efforts from India, from China. None of them seem to get there. And I, a long time ago, developed a theory. You might call it a conspiracy theory, that the U.S. has equipment there. And not just a little bit of equipment, but tactical equipment. Not people. I don't believe they have any people there, but they have tactical equipment on Mars and surrounding Mars. Because, and this idea that these little rovers are running around and somehow that's the best technology that we can muster up to send to Mars is complete baloney. And we don't even know if what you're seeing with those is from Mars. There's been evidence that the pictures they're showing you are from the Southwest Desert in the United States. But at any rate, that's, you know, I don't want to go there because, once again, these are unsubstantiated scientific claims. NASA is putting out data and cannot substantiate it. Science is very simple. You do an experiment, you do theoretical work, you make predictions, and then you try and put it all together to advance knowledge. Part of that process is that you get third-party independent verification. That means that somebody else has to look at your work and say, yeah, what this guy did is legitimate, and that gives it credibility. And the more people that have third-party independent verification, the better it is. And so none of the activity on Mars, none of the Apollo landings, the alleged Apollo landings, have third-party verification. So it is unsubstantiated scientific claims. That's all it is. Am I saying NASA didn't go to the moon? No, I don't have to. That's up to them to have this material, these claims substantiated by independent third parties, and it's never been done. So in the scientific sense, they are unsubstantiated. When I, for example, made a claim that the fusion of the sun is at the surface of the sun, that was a scientific claim. When I was working with the Russian scientists in the mid-1990s, they devised a very ingenious experiment. They took an X-ray detector. I described this in my weather book, where they scanned across the surface of the sun, and as they scanned, they would subtract off the reading that they got before, and that allowed them to see the X-rays that were coming deeper and deeper from within the sun. And so the end result is that the X-rays were cooler and cooler until they got down to a certain level, and there was a long block across the center part of the sun that was the same. In other words, the sun has a large planetary core. It's not a hydrogen core. It's like a planetary core. But it proved that my concept was correct, and it showed the experiment and how it was done so that anybody else could do that experiment. That is verified scientific results. It's a scientific claim. It has a theoretical basis. There's scientific theoretical work that goes along with it. And then there's an experiment that can verify this. The experiment is performed, and then the methodology of the experiment is made public so that other people can verify that same result. And so, anyway, the independent verification has already been done by the Russians. And so now, if other people want to do that, and I bet you $1 million that somebody in the U.S. Space Agency, I guarantee you, have gone through that in the military, what I call Tier 1 science. I guarantee you they have done that same simple experiment and possibly other ones to determine the exact same result, and that proving that the fusion of the sun is in the upper atmosphere of the sun, or it's in the atmosphere. And that brings along a whole laundry list of other topics, like it's very easy to create fusion. Fusion is a very simple process. But these giant collider reactors that they're using are designed for failure. They're meant to fail. And that's tier two science at its best. A lot of money placed in the wrong direction, and that's what I've always said. Anything that will not work gets funded. But returning to the Schiaparelli lander, now this was a satellite-lander combination where there was a satellite that still is orbiting Mars to do atmospheric research and determine the species of atmospheric components in the upper atmosphere of Mars. Part of what they're looking for is methane, and I talked about this last week, that methane is not a symptom of life. In fact, it's very safe to say in the universe, or at a planet like Mars, which is basically a pretty dead planet. I mean, it's if you look at the livelihood or the life-bearing properties of Mars, they're pretty nil. I mean, there might be some microscopic bacteria there, but I doubt if you're going to see methane. NASA had a jolt of methane, 2014. One of their detectors detected a surge in methane. Well, that probably came from the discharge of the solar capacitor and an influx from outer space. Just like we get influxes of water, we get other chemicals from outer space constantly on Earth. But be that as it may, that's open for speculation, but it probably didn't come from cows on Mars. I would say that is one of the safer bets going. But now that the Schiaparelli lander vehicle crashed, they think that the retro rockets didn't work. They think there might even have been an explosion, which to me spanks of directed energy beam weaponry around Mars. And why would you have directed weaponry around Mars? Because Mars is really our nearest habitable neighbor planet in that you could actually land on. Our moon is one of them. But Mars is a place that we really can't see very well from Earth. And so having equipment on Mars that's monitoring it 24/7 would be important from a strategic point of view. If you were going to spend Black Ops money, it really wouldn't cost that much to build some orbiting space stations and probably throw up some laser satellites or something else that could do some minor protection, not so much of aliens, but of other countries' spacecraft going to Mars. What do you want to bet that the Schiaparelli spacecraft orbiting Mars has a very short lifetime. And we watched this continually through the decades. As somebody would send out a probe to Mars, it wouldn't make it. All of a sudden, it lost communication. So anyway, I think somebody's out there protecting Mars. Now, in my paid cast, one of the very early ones, I believe it was in August, it was one of the, in the ongoing series, The World Before the Great Flood, I talk about Mars and the historical information we had about Baal coming from Mars. I talked that pretty much that whole show was dedicated to Baal and Baal worship and how that is used on Earth today. The people in power in Washington, there's a lot of Baal worship. The symbolism in New York City, on Wall Street, around the financial centers, is strictly Baal worship symbolism. Washington, D.C. is filled with Baal worship and devil worship symbolism. And so anyway, this is related to Mars. Now, is it true that there was civilizations of people living on Mars? My personal opinion is that the historical record is very clear that there was. And that when Venus the comet came through, it ripped the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars. And before that happened, those people saw this coming and they got out of there. That was Baal. He was the head honcho on Mars. And that's the same clan of people that are running the Rothschild banking empire and the usury, etc., keeping this world enslaved. It's the same techniques, it's the same people. This word bail, just look at it for a minute. If you bail out a boat, that means you're bailing out. There's like a crisis situation. If you bail out, that means something's going on and you got to get out of there like right now. You bail out. Bail is related to the kind of the bad guy who lived on Mars. The Flash Gordon series was based on this. They called him Ming the Merciless in the Flash Gordon series, but it's based on Baal living on Mars. So do I know for sure there was somebody living on Mars? No, but it all adds up. And it's very clear that the CIA, who is in charge of science in the United States, has an interest in protecting information regarding Mars. But that leads us, I'm not going to go into this in detail, but, you know, Elon Musk and now Jeff Bezos and Obama and Boeing, all these guys are going to Mars. But the reality is nobody's going to Mars. They want to send people to Mars. Why don't they send spacecraft to Mars first? They want to go immediately to send people to Mars, a very, very difficult proposition. They should be sending people into space stations where they can orbit Mars and then have an occasional lander go down and then or have remote vehicles on the ground. Because if you can live in a space station, you can live in a space station around Mars, around the moon. You can come back. You have all of your ability to live there. And, you know, it's much easier. Landing someplace is difficult. Getting off of the planet is even more difficult. You have to understand that Mars is different than Earth because it has a very faint atmosphere, so you cannot glide in with an airplane-type vehicle and land on Mars. Parachutes really don't work well on Mars, although the Schiaparelli lander tried to use parachutes. So enough of that. Interesting that the Schiaparelli lander met an early demise, never got to the ground, never pulled out any information. Because I think they're worried that people are going to find out that they've been faking these Mars landers information. And plus actually find some real things. If that's the scenario that happened on Mars, that Venus the comet came by as we have been told, that's what Velikovsky's story was, and it really fits together. My science work verifies what Velikovsky was saying, and like I've said many times, I didn't set out to prove Velikovsky correct. It's just that I was working independently and came to the same conclusions by a completely different route. But that would indicate that there are buildings, ruins, or whatever you want to call them, on Mars. Now, I'm not talking about the face on Mars. I'm not talking about a lot of the other misinformation that comes out about Mars. I'm talking about real constructions on Mars that are obviously they're not going to send pictures that you and I can see or anybody else can see. They've been filtering pictures since I was in the working around NASA scientists in the late 1970s. The Malin Space Industries control, a lot of people don't know, NASA never owned the cameras on any of its spacecraft. All of it filtered through a company called Malin Space Industries out in L.A. And I met David Malin one time. He's a young guy, and I go, how is it this guy has control of all of the cameras of NASA? Well, after a while, I learned about the secret societies, the controlling bankers who controlled the science industry and scientists and NASA. So that's how it all is put together. Okay, on to the main science topic. I'm talking about this recent announcement about so-called Planet Nine. Oh my goodness. The news media is so lame. And recent studies have shown that 94% of the public don't pay attention to standard news media, and science is the worst. I mean, if you think science, or if you think reporting is bad in politics, it can't hold a candle to the bad reporting in science. But at any rate, just to be specific, just to make sure and clear the air right in the very beginning, nobody has discovered Planet Nine out there beyond Neptune, trans-Neptunian planets. They have discovered a bunch of smaller planets, which have been identified. They've actually visibly been verified. And they're kind of in a pattern, and they kind of are moving in about the same direction. So they say, how could this be? The only way it could possibly be is if there's something big out there, which is creating a gravitational field and dragging these along. They claim that this Planet Nine nearest approach to our solar system is at 50 AU, 50 astronomical units. And it goes out to, you know, thousands of AU on the farthest end of its orbit. In other words, it's an elliptical orbit. Just by contrast, Neptune's orbit is around 30 AU. AU is an astronomical unit. It's the distance from the sun to the Earth. So it's a commonly used measure of distance in astronomical measurement. So Earth is 1 AU from the sun, one astronomical unit. Neptune is 30.1 astronomical units from the sun. The nearest approach of this alleged Planet Nine is 50 AU. They've never discovered it. They don't have equipment that could technically discover this. They're looking. There are automated searches, and they've discovered a bunch of smaller planets that are kind of out in that area. So that's the end result. Remember that they demoted Pluto from being a planet, and the reason was they had a little problem. If Pluto were the ninth planet, now they would be talking about Planet X or Planet 10, Planet X. X being the Roman numeral for 10. So now they can very conveniently talk about Planet 9 and not cross that boundary of terminology talking about Planet 10. But Pluto should have never been demoted as a planet. It is very much a planet. And the definition of planet in the astronomical community is an astronomical body that controls the region of the solar system in its orbit. And since Pluto is small and since it's way out there, it does not really control the path. In other words, material in its orbit would be controlled by that object. Earth, in a sense, could be considered a planet by that definition. Venus potentially could be termed a planet by that definition. But Mars would not be, under that definition, would not fit the requirements of being a planet, because Mars does not control the space where it is. The asteroid belt really dominates where Mars is, but Mars does not sweep out a path. Mars is very small. And so the influence of Mars is extremely limited in its orbital path. So literally, Mars could not be considered a planet by that definition. And so then we're down to eight planets. Jupiter certainly maintains control over its path. Saturn potentially could, but Neptune probably doesn't either, and Uranus certainly does not. So that definition is bogus. The definition of a planet should simply be something that is spherical. In other words, it's round enough to have, during the formation process, which is, by the way, for all of these, it's the comet process, which creates a tremendous amount of heat and then also brings in the case of some of them, atmosphere. But the heat of formation is sufficient that it's not a strange oblong shape. The heat of formation is sufficient that it's molten, and the surface, at least, collapses in gravitationally, forming a sphere. Okay, so the nucleus of Halley's Comet is a potato shape. It's a single piece of rock. The nucleus of Comet 67P is kind of a potato shape. It's almost a dumbbell-shaped piece of rock, so it's not a planet. Mars would qualify as a planet. Pluto would qualify as a planet. Charon, the moon of Pluto, would qualify as a planet. And all of these objects they're seeing out there in what is known as the Kuiper Belt would also qualify as planets. But they had a little problem, because how could they go from everybody learning in textbooks from the time they were old enough to read that there are nine planets, and all of a sudden there's hundreds of planets. And then NASA has to deny that there's any such thing as Planet X that could come into the solar system and do damage. Let me just remind you, my study of over a year ago now, published July 23rd, 2015, proved conclusively that what everybody had been calling Nibiru or Planet X from the historical record was, in fact, the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. Now that is confirmed. There's no question. So if you were ever wondering why there was such a uproar and disinformation and everything else regarding Hale-Bopp, it's because its nucleus was literally Nibiru. It came through the solar system and left. When it was originally discovered, it was on a direct collision course with Earth. That was in 1991 during the George Bush Sr. presidency, and he brought in Dan Golden from the CIA to put the lid on NASA. I remember when it happened, and I was going, what the heck's going on here? This is sure nuts. Well, it took me, what, how many years? 25 years to figure out what was going on. But I did the research. I went back and I did the astronomical research, the follow-up work. No question about it. And this idea that Sitchin came up with of a so-called 3,600-year orbit is false. I always knew it was false. Sitchin got that information from Harrington at the Naval Observatory in around 1986 in a conversation with Harrington. And that was Harrington's best information at the time. They published this in books, and not Harrington, but the Sitchin's books. Sitchin published this, and this had been repeated and repeated and repeated through all of the decades of BS about Planet X. And It is patently incorrect. It should be, well, in my work, it's been retracted and proven completely incorrect. But imagine all the people that are out there still mouthing this. I won't even say it anymore because it doesn't deserve airtime. But the alleged knowledge of an orbit of Hale-Bopp was totally incorrect. And so anyway, now we're coming out. The astronomical community is trying to grab the press and the headlines regarding this alleged Planet Nine. And of course, as usual, it's out there, it's far away, out of time, out of mind, out of our solar system, not something to worry about. So this is the latest ploy on trying to control the media over the topic of Planet X. Okay, so at this point, I'm going to start talking a little bit about the orbital dynamics. I've got a picture that I'm posting on my webpage down in the picture of the day. And by the way, I apologize for the picture of the day had not been updated really for about a month. And it just shows that I've been busy with some other tasks, let's put it that way. Not to the least of which, I had some, let's say, some problems with a little help from our friends with some of my computer equipment. Not the server, not the web page this time. That all was just fine. So I made some steps and did some things, some upgrades that were very long overdue, and so turned a bad thing into a good thing in a sense. But at any rate, this took a lot of my time. So anyway, I apologize for not having that part of the webpage updated regularly. So I'm going to talk a little bit about orbital dynamics now. The nine or so planets that they have been talking about here. Okay, so if you look at these orbits, they are really very much disjoint. They show that each one of them is marked. Planet 9 is this big circle, and the dark orange part and the light orange part of the orbit indicate below and above the ecliptic of plane of the planets. And so apparently it's on a somewhat exaggerated orbit. In other words, it's inclined quite a bit to the orbits of the other planets. But to imagine that how somehow affects these other orbits is really a stretch of the imagination, because where all of these orbits coalesce, none of those coalescent points are near the orbit of Planet Nine. So I think, just from a purely technical point of view, strictly looking at this objectively, not as I try and do some negative analysis a lot of times with NASA, but and the boys out there, the astronomy boys, just looking completely objectively at the claim that they're making. Now remember, Planet Nine has never been discovered. It's a hypothetical planet based on their belief that there's something out there influencing these other objects. I don't see that at all. I would see that there's something much closer to the solar system and not at all related to this Planet Nine. So I think they're just, the Planet Nine orbit that they're looking at here is extremely far away from the rest of the objects. So I don't see it as being a legitimate proposal at all. I'm going to pull up this article and just read a few lines from it. It says that last week, let me just pull this up quickly again. Studies presented last week at a meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Pasadena are giving them extra encouragement. Researchers have found another three trans-Neptunian objects that, like the first six, may corroborate Planet Nine's existence and help narrow down its putative orbit. The influence of the unseen giant could also explain the strange orbits of two more objects perpendicular to the plane of the solar system, and it might explain why the sun is tipped slightly on its axis. I mean, they're just digging deeper and deeper here. There's none of this has anything to do in a direct way with the evidence they're presenting here of having the sun tipped on its axis. There's 90% probability sure that there's a planet out there, but other clues are sparse and unconvincing. And then another astronomer gives it a 1% chance of turning out to be real. It's said by J.J. Cavillars of the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria, Canada. So anyway, I don't put a lot of credence on this. So what is the real story of Planet X? And there have been many claims. Like I said, I started out saying earlier, I was on Tim Spencer's show last Saturday. Somebody called in and goes, oh, there's a guy on YouTube. He's got a picture of something, and he claims it's Planet X, and it's going to be here tomorrow. I don't know, some garbage. And right out of the chute, it doesn't get past door one of my series of qualifications for a legitimate claim. Does the guy use his name? No, it was some guy named Dave. I mean, if the guy doesn't even use his own real name and is identifiable, hey, shut it off right there. Go away. That's indication number one that they're not for real. And number two, no credentials of any kind presented. No information regarding authenticity or believability. And then, I mean, it just went downhill from there. The real story on Planet X, in a nutshell, the Nibiru object that everybody talks about, that's in the Wormwood in the Bible, etc., was the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. No question about it. It was it's on an orbit which crosses Earth's orbit. And in the past, it comes around at the time, Hale-Bopp's nucleus orbit was around 4,250 years, which would put it at about the right place for the Noah's Flood. So that's just speculation, but it's a much sounder story than what these guys are presenting and actually getting published in scientific journals. But the end result is that the Nibiru Planet X object has already gone through the solar system. It missed us. It's on its way out. It won't be back for another 2,600 years. So nobody out there has to worry about that particular one. However, there are many Planet X type of objects. And these, when I say Planet X, the one I'm referring to is the one that you out there might be concerned about because they would come into the solar system. But the possibility that an object coming into the solar system would ever come anywhere close to Earth, it is extremely remote. This idea that Planet X would come back every 3,600 years and damage Earth is just a myth. Even if there were an object like that, it would not encounter Earth every time it came back, as the orbital dynamics simply would not allow it. And so, but let's look at, say, geology of the Earth, of planet Earth, the layering. If you go to many places, there's a road that's cut around the mountains, say the Colorado Rockies, or many, many places. If you're out in Pennsylvania or many other places, any place where there's hills, and they had to cut a hill away to make the road. You look at the layering of the landscape, and there might be a foot of some kind of hard rock, sediment rock, and then there's a couple inches of gravel, and then there's 10 feet of something else. And all of this was building up as the Earth was forming. And you see this layering going on if you go another 2 miles down the road and there's another hill that's cut. You see that same layering pattern in the next hill where they had to cut away to make the road. So what's going on is this Earth has been layered up many, many, many times. In fact, we could have a planet Earth here that could be 10 billion years old. There's no way of really knowing. But the only thing you can say for sure is that the geology and the dating and the explanations for Earth are totally incorrect. I remember being out at Bryce Canyon and reading the explanation, and they said Bryce Canyon is a sunken canyon. Is it in Utah or Nevada? I forget. But anyway, it's just sunken down many, many hundreds of feet, possibly in places as much as 1,000 feet. And the end result is that you can see the walls of the canyon. It's like a big hollowed out area where the land just dropped down. You can see the layering in the walls of the canyon of the earth building up. My point was that in the geological explanations written by the geologists who are trying to give the public an information about this, they said, 1.7 million years ago, it rose up, and then so many million years later, it dropped down, and then it rose up again and dropped down, and it's just fairy tale. I mean, there's absolutely no justification for anything they're saying. Or how did the Earth just all of a sudden do this? Pop up and drop down and pop up again later. It's absurd, absolutely absurd. So the history of Earth that you're being taught is totally ridiculous. Earth is probably much older than 4.5 billion years old. Who knows? I mean, we really don't know. The solar system as a whole could be much older. We really don't know. The methods for measuring ages are totally bogus. We're just beginning to discover the layering and the physical makeup of this planet and other planets. So for somebody to come out and say, oh yeah, it all formed 4.5 billion years ago. I mean, it is so silly. It is so ridiculous. It is so absurd that it is beyond belief. And that's why when we tell kids to do homeschooling, the only good reason to send your kids to school is for a social reason, to have some social interaction with other kids, because eventually they're going to get out in the world and interact with other people. So teach them, when you teach them something, teach them at home. The textbooks are absolutely garbage. The textbooks that teach kids, especially anything about science or about history, absolute pure garbage. One other end result is that if they discover a planet out there, it probably will not have the orbit that they're talking about here. It would have a very different orbit. So this has happened before, where people were looking for a planet and discovered Pluto. That's how Pluto was discovered, by accident. And then they thought this was the planet they were looking for because of the influence of some object on Neptune and Uranus. That's how they discovered Pluto, but the end result is that Pluto was not the object that they theorized nor that they were looking for. So I think that what these people are trying to do is set themselves up to be another Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered the planet Pluto. Anyway, we'll have to wait and see. But the important issue, number one, they're trying to take over the news media with this chatter about this Planet 9 object. They're calling it Planet 9, not 10. And they're looking for something far out in the solar system, beyond the solar system, that goes, its nearest point is an extreme distance from the sun, and its farthest point is even farther. So the end result is that they are moving this whole idea of planet, some other planet, out of time and space that might affect you or me. And so that's part of the end result. They wouldn't get to first base. They wouldn't be allowed to even put a hint of this in any of the news media if that were not the case. So The end result, are there Planet X objects? Yes. The one we call Nibiru, or Wormwood, the biblical reference, is related to the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, which came and went. It's gone. It's out of the solar system. So it's now it's time to start looking for other Planet X-type objects with real equipment. And that's the other thing, is these guys are spending all their time looking out into Never Never Land, and they're ignoring the searches that should be going on relative to other areas of the solar system that would be more fruitful relative to objects that might come in and actually do damage to the planets. Possibly Earth, possibly. But as I said, any object coming into the solar system, you have to identify an orbit, and only at that point can you make a determination if it's going to have a major effect on any of the planets, including Earth. Okay, so a quick couple minutes left here. My red letter sale is still on my sales page. The Imperial filters, we caught up. The September rush on Imperial filters, we got caught up, and we have Imperial filters on the shelf. People have been buying, and it is a very good deal. The complete, the complete survival and book library package, and it includes the water filter, the kitchen standard water filter, a 10-pack of the filter elements, the pre-filter accessory set, the 2-liter personal travel filter, plus the complete library of my books, CDs, etc. So it's really a good deal, and if you upgrade to the Imperial filters in that package, it's just $100 more. It's a super deal. Quite a few people have been buying that lately. I encourage you to take a look at that. My book, CDs, DVD library is all on that webpage. Go to the main webpage, jmccsci.com, and of course the paid cast. I want to encourage you, if you have not joined the paid cast yet, it's $3.95 a month, one extra hour per week, where I do a deep dive into esoteric scientific topics. This week's topic is under the ongoing series Radiation and You, Space Radiation, What NASA Is Not Telling You. So at any rate, that's $3.95 a month. And you get, it's less than a cup of coffee. And also that helps helps with my ongoing expenses relative to this radio show, the webpage, all of the other expenses that go along with having an operation like this. So I encourage you to go there. And the water filters, once again, the water filters are all in one, no add-on filters required, no priming required. The Imperial filters are double diameter, twice the flow rate, and four times the lifetime. Once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.